You're listening to Feedback with Bill Saunders on News Talk 830 WEEU and 830WEEU.com. A new generation of talk.
Blues Brothers, it's got to be the Friday edition of Feedback. You're on air, Town Square, here on the voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Saunders. Sean Tansky is off today. And right now, Mike Keller is sitting in as my producer today, which I thank him for doing. Sean will be back on Monday. Sean's one of the lucky ones. He's heading down to Citizens Bank Park today. To watch the home opener. And, of course, yours truly is decked out in red today. Red and a little bit of blue to remember their new uniform colors. I know Mike Keller probably wants to say something. Did you want to say something there, Mr. Keller?
I think I've said enough. I think everyone would agree on that, don't you think so?
Well, the look you give me, it's just you're dying to say something else, I know.
Well, I just have to give you that look. That's in actually the contract I signed here, that I have to give you a disapproving look at least four times a day.
And he does, too.
Yeah. I've already gone over the quota for today.
Folks, if only you knew what goes on off the air, I'm telling you. Anyway, our phone number is 0610-374-8800 or toll-free 888-401-0459. And our dedicated text line, if you want to text us your opinion, is 484-650-3373. And, of course, our email address is feedback at 830weeu.com. All right, let's take a look and see what today's top three topics are. A federal appeals court ruling will affect mail-in ballots here in Pennsylvania that don't have a proper date on the outside envelope. We'll explain. New polls out show Pennsylvania is in play for the presidential and senatorial races. It seems to be a ping pong tournament going on here as to who leads in the polls in any given week. And a local congressman wants to know why. And here's a question I've heard somewhere before. He wants to know why federal tax dollars should be used to rebuild the Francis Scott Key Bridge. And at 10 this morning, Berks County Commissioner Chairman Christian Leinbach will join me. And your questions are welcome during that hour. All right. With that said, let's get started. Let's start with the latest ruling by a federal appeals court. I got this from the Associated Press. A requirement for Pennsylvania voters to put accurate handwritten dates on the outside envelopes of their mail-in ballots does not run afoul of a civil rights law. A federal appeals court panel ruled this week, overturning a lower court ruling. A divided third U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled to uphold enforcement of the required date on return envelopes. That's a technical mandate that caused thousands of votes to be declared invalid in the 2022 election. The total number is a small fraction of the large state's electorate, but the court's ruling puts additional attention on Pennsylvania's election procedures ahead of a presidential election in which its electoral college votes are up for grabs. According to the AP, a lower court judge had ruled back in November that even without the proper dates, mail-in ballots should be counted if they are received in time. U.S. District Judge Susan Paradise Baxter said the envelope date is irrelevant in helping elections officials decide whether a ballot was received in time or if a voter is qualified. In the court's opinion, Judge Thomas Ambrose said the section of the 1964 Civil Rights Act that the lower court relied upon does not pertain to ballot casting rules broadly, such as dates on envelopes, but is concerned only with the process of determining a voter's eligibility to cast a ballot. The Pennsylvania General Assembly has decided that mail-in voters must date the declaration on the return envelope of their ballot to make their vote effective, Ambrose wrote. The Supreme Court of Pennsylvania unanimously held this ballot casting rule is mandatory. Thus, failure to comply renders a ballot invalid under Pennsylvania law. The American Civil Liberties Union of Pennsylvania, which helped represent groups and voters who challenged the date mandate, said the ruling could mean thousands of votes won't be counted over what it called a meaningless error. Here's what they said. This is Ari Savitsky, who is a lawyer with the ACLU's Voting Rights Project. He said this to the AP. We strongly disagree with the panel majority's conclusion that voters may be disenfranchised for a minor paperwork error like forgetting to write an irrelevant date on the return envelope of their mail ballot. He went on to say, we are considering all of our options at this time, so this may not be done yet. State and national Republican groups defended the date requirement, and the Republican National Committee called the decision a crucial victory for election integrity and voter confidence. Here in Pennsylvania, Democrats have been far more likely to vote by mail than Republicans under an expansion of mail-in ballots that was enacted back in 2019. This is one of the things that I'm going to talk with County Commissioner Christian Leinbach about. All these election laws, the back and forth between courts and the different decisions that are made, and what kind of impact that has at the county level and the elections people in particular. And if it results in confusion at the local level. So that's one of the things I'm going to talk with Commissioner Leinbach about when he's in the studio with me this morning. Well, new polls are out. Surprise, surprise. And I don't know, you can take these polls with a grain of salt because you know darn full well they're going to change between now and November. But this time, according to Delaware Valley Journal, which is where I got this article, the newer polls show that Pennsylvania's in the midst of a ping-pong contest between Democratic President Joe Biden and Republican Donald Trump, still bouncing within the margin of error. The fight over Pennsylvania's U.S. Senate seat also remains tight, with Republican Dave McCormick trailing incumbent Democrat Senator Bob Casey Jr. only by single digits now. A Susquehanna polling and research survey of 450 likely voters found Biden led Trump 50-45%, just outside the margin of error. While that poll was just released, the survey itself was conducted from February 27th to March 6th. Perhaps most notably, Biden's 5-point edge is down from Susquehanna's January poll when Biden led by 8 points. At that time, it was 47%-39%. In another sign of how close the Keystone State race is likely to be, a Bloomberg poll of 807 registered voters conducted from March 8th to the 12th had the race tied at 45%. A previous Bloomberg poll gave Trump a 6-point lead. Biden's approval rating remained near historic lows at 40.5%. 55% of voters disapprove of the president. So why would an extremely unpopular Democrat poll better or equal to his Republican competition? Well, according to Public Affairs Executive Larry Kessler, and he said this to the Delaware Valley Journal reporter, voters are faced with a binary choice for president. It's solidifying. It's going to be a very close election. Oh, my, oh, my. Republicans weren't concerned that Keystone State voters would pick Biden in November. Although recently released, the Susquehanna poll is an old poll, taken almost a month ago, said longtime GOP strategist Charlie Giroux, who went on to say more recent polls show Trump winning Pennsylvania. The Rear Clear Politics poll average gives Trump an extremely slim 0.2% lead in the state of Pennsylvania right now. In an email to DV Journal, Susquehanna Polling and Research President and CEO James Lee acknowledged the results could be considered stale because they weren't released for weeks. He said, we wanted to be completely transparent about the dates the poll was conducted so you can decide for yourself. Well, that revelation isn't a concern to Dr. Christopher Borick. He is a political science professor at Muhlenberg College. He said for this article that he didn't expect any dramatic shifts in polling because Americans have a deep level of familiarity with Biden and Trump. As for the Senate race, Borick said McCormick's campaign could take heart that he's polling within a few points of Casey, an incumbent who sailed to re-election victories in 2012 and 2018. Borick added the Casey camp could also see the poll as a positive because all other polls gave him a lead, albeit one that continues to tighten. He said going into a competitive election cycle and having any advantage is probably welcome news. Democratic strategists like Neil Oxman expressed confidence that Casey will remain on top. Here's what he said for this article. I think that Casey is Pennsylvania. He really represents the majority of Pennsylvanians, he said. He has a lot of independent voters, and he has a lot of Republicans who support him as well. Well, an Emerson College poll from earlier this month found 9% of those surveyed would vote for Trump and Casey. McCormick has touted his endorsements from the Pennsylvania Republican Party, GOP congressmen, and law enforcement groups, including the Delaware County Fraternal Order of Police. He avoided a nasty primary fight when the Pennsylvania Department of State removed one candidate from the ballot while another withdrew. By the way, I'm going to talk Commissioner Linebach about that later on because there was a question as to who would appear on the ballot for the Senate race resulted in the county postponing getting its ballots ready. So I'm going to ask him where we stand now with that, now that we have that cleared up and it's McCormick who's going to be on the ballot now. Kessler, however, wondered if there was still skepticism about McCormick following the 2022 U.S. Senate Republican primary, where he narrowly lost to Dr. Mehmet Oz. Oz, who was endorsed at the time by Trump, lost to Democrat John Fetterman. McCormick endorsed Trump for president shortly after Super Tuesday, but Trump has not weighed in on the Pennsylvania Senate race. McCormick is probably looking for the best of both worlds with Trump, but he could also end up with the worst of both worlds with Trump, observed Kessler. The Casey and McCormick campaigns did not comment for this article that appears in the Delaware Valley Journal. So, of course, we'll keep on top of the latest polls, and that ping-pong approach will probably continue. All right, when we come back, we're going to address the question, why is the price of gasoline rising and rising so fast? That and much more when the Friday edition of Feedback, your on-air town square, continues in just a bit.
News you can use.
I feel more informed when I listen.
News Talk 830, WEEU.
And now back to Feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and Beyond.
or toll free, 888-401-0459. Those are the numbers for you to call if you'd like to weigh in on the topics of the day. Here on the voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU, and Feedback, your on-air town square. By the way, on Monday, Congresswoman Chrissy Houlihan, who represents parts of Berks and Chester counties in the 6th Congressional District, will be my guest Monday morning at 11:30. So that's coming up on Monday. Chrissy Houlihan will be here on Feedback. Hope you'll tune us in on that day. All right, yeah. Have you noticed how quickly the price of gasoline is going up at the pump lately? And if you're like me, you're probably wondering, why is that the case? Well, the Wall Street Journal's got an interesting article in their paper today that explains the reasons why. They say that the prices at the pump typically rise in the first half of the year as more Americans get back on the road and refiners transition to less polluting summer blends. But costs this year have ramped up faster than normal, thanks largely to severe weather at home and geopolitical disruptions abroad. Unleaded gasoline ran $3.54 a gallon on average across the United States on Wednesday, according to AAA. That's up 3% from a year ago and about 14% higher than at the start of 2024. The uptick was helped make inflation stickier than expected in the first quarter and weighed on Americans' outlook on a largely robust U.S. economy. Gasoline and shelter contributed more than 60% of the consumer price index's increase in February from a year ago, according to the Labor Department, marking the first month since September that spending at the pump edged higher. The Fed's preferred inflation gauge doesn't include volatile food and energy costs. Still, rising prices displayed on corner gas stations and highway billboards are constant reminders of economic pressures. Bets by energy investors on Wall Street, according to the Wall Street Journal, suggest that the price gains have room to run. The cost of gasoline shipments into New York Harbor next month has jumped 31% since the beginning of the year. That is faster than the average increase of 20% during the same period over the past quarter century, according to FactSet. Even after the recent run-up, we still see upside risk for gas prices, so said Bank of America to its clients in a note recently. So I guess you can expect to see the prices go even higher, at least in the near term, as we go through the spring months here. Speaking of the price of gasoline, let's talk about EVs. Get the latest from there. I got this from the Associated Press. More than 2 years after the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program was established through the infrastructure bill that President Biden signed back in November of 2021, only four states, Ohio, New York, Pennsylvania, and Hawaii, have opened EV stations funded by the program. Four states. And it's been nearly, we're going on the third year now since the president signed that infrastructure bill. Biden had set a goal of creating a national network of 500,000 publicly available chargers by 2030. Easily accessible charging ports are a key part of his effort to encourage drivers to move away from gasoline-powered cars and trucks that contribute to global warming. That effort took on greater urgency this month as the Biden administration announced new automobile emission standards that officials called the most ambitious plan ever to cut planet warming pollution from passenger vehicles. The AP reports that meeting those standards would require a huge increase in sales of EVs and plug-in hybrids. EVs hit a record 1.19 million in sales in the U.S. last year and accounted for 7.6% of the total U.S. vehicle market. That's up from 5.8% in 2022. Transportation emissions are the nation's largest source of greenhouse gases, the AP reports. The Biden administration says the federal charging program is on track. Several states, including Maine, Vermont, and Colorado, are expected to open public charging stations later this year, while more than a dozen others have awarded contracts for projects or broken ground. As part of the national charging station rollout, the Biden administration awarded $623 million in grants to states, local governments, and tribes back in January. The grants will fund 47 EV charging stations and related projects in 22 states and Puerto Rico, including 7,500 charging ports. Now, if my arithmetic is correct, $623 million for 47 EV charging stations and that includes 7,500 charging ports, that comes to $13,255,319 per station. That's taxpayer dollars there, folks. And we're approaching $35 trillion in total debt now. Separately, AP says Walmart and other private companies have pledged to build a network of affordable fast-charging stations for EVs. The federal program is also expected to serve as a catalyst for other projects. But even some of the government's own experts say 500,000 public chargers won't be enough to meet Biden's ambitious climate goals. How come that comes as no surprise to me? The Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory estimated last year that the U.S. will need 1.2 million public chargers by 2030, a huge jump from the 175,000 public charging ports now available as measured by the Alternative Fuels Data Center, which is a division of the Energy Department. The availability of charging stations is key to persuading Americans to buy these EVs. Driving range anxiety is still an impediment, along with cost, according to the AP. About 80% of respondents cited concerns about a lack of charging stations as a reason not to buy an electric vehicle, according to a 2023 survey from the Associated Press, NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, and the Energy Policy Institute at the University of Chicago. 7 in 10 said they would not buy an EV because it takes too long to charge, and the battery technology isn't ready. And these are things we've talked about on this show in the past. In some parts of the country, especially rural areas, far from major cities, there are definitely corridors where you have worries about range anxiety. It's going to take longer to get to them, just like it took longer to get cell phone coverage in those places, experts say. But the administration's goal is to have chargers every 50 miles along U.S. interstates. Well, that's fine if you're driving on an interstate, but how about local roadways? Other major charging networks offered by Tesla, EVgo, and Electrify America prioritize shopping centers, gas stations, and grocery stores, but long-distance travel is where many Americans perceive the biggest gap. So those anxieties over EVs still are there. They're not going away, and they probably won't anytime soon. Interesting piece, another piece that appears in the Wall Street Journal. I was going to get to this yesterday, but we didn't have time for it. But Jonathan Lesser and Mark Mills, both with the National Center for Energy Analytics, have an interesting op-ed piece in the journal with the headline, "Can We Power the EPA's EV Fantasy?" The subhead reads, "The overhaul of electrical grids and distribution would require labor and resources we don't have." So let me share with you what Messrs. Lesser and Mills have to write here in the Wall Street Journal. The futurists at the Environmental Protection Agency are confident that electric vehicles will soon become cheap, reliable, and easy to fuel. That's the main bet in the agency's new standard for carbon dioxide emissions released last week. Critics have rightly called the rule a backdoor EV mandate. The EPA admits it can be met only if EVs compose well above half of new vehicle sales by 2032. That isn't happening anytime soon, they write. EVs are a niche product, used mostly by high-income urban consumers who have garages. Electric cars accounted for shy of 8% of new auto sales last year and drained billions from automakers' profits. It isn't unreasonable for EV aficionados to hope for more business as technology progresses and perhaps as low-cost Chinese EVs flood the market. Now, whether the former happens quickly enough is one bet, and whether policymakers will be happy with Chinese car companies bankrupting American firms is another. There is, however, another wild card in the EPA's gamble. Widespread adoption of EVs will require an unprecedented and staggeringly expensive expansion of local electrical grids. This will require a huge increase in the production of electrical transformers, along with more power plants and transmission lines to produce and deliver energy. This overhaul must include upgrading local grid distribution at the roughly 3,000 electric utilities across the country. The wires, poles, and transformers that line our streets. There are 60 million to 80 million distribution transformers in neighborhoods designed for existing loads. Around 1 million new ones are sold annually, two-thirds of which replace aged-out transformers. That replacement rate isn't close to meeting the EPA's dreams. Millions more and heavier transformers will be needed to handle higher power levels and more frequent use, even if many EVs are charged overnight. This will also require replacing many of the existing utility poles to handle new transformers' extra weight. On an individual level, millions of homes and apartment complexes will need electrical upgrades to accommodate at-home chargers. Consumers and taxpayers will pay for that multi-billion dollar price tag, whether through taxes or higher utility rates. Electricians will need to install new circuits for EV chargers, and many older homes will need new power panels to handle the increased demand. on-road fueling will still be needed, particularly for the millions of consumers without garages. Replicating the nation's some 195,000 retail gasoline stations will require far more than the 4,000 charging facilities that the Federal Highway Administration has proposed. Given the physics of electricity, thousands of these charging stations will each have the power demand of an entire town, rather than that of a typical convenience store. That will mean more massive upgrades, in this case, for higher voltage grid systems, and critically, thousands of new, large transmission-level transformers. I'm reading directly from an op-ed piece that appears in the Wall Street Journal. For EV enthusiasts, this overhaul is doable with the right amount of money, yet they're naive about the magnitude. One Energy Department study estimated some $50 to $125 billion, that's billion with a B, in infrastructure upgrades will be needed to support EVs, composing 10% of all on-road cars. Today, they amount to less than 2%. We estimate that achieving the EPA's goal will require north of $1 trillion in grid upgrades by 2035. $1 trillion, you know what that means. That means your electric bills are going to go sky high, because you folks are going to be paying for these upgrades. Money aside, transformers will be the big roadblock. Delivery of the largest utility transformers can already take several years, and overall transformer costs have risen 70% since 2018. Replacing tens of millions of distribution transformers would require massive quantities of copper, most of which would have to be imported, of course. The process would also exceed the production capabilities of the handful of American manufacturers. The U.S. is heavily dependent on imports for large substation transformers, especially from Asia, itself raising obvious national security issues. The unique electrical steel needed for transformers and electric motors is also in short supply. Served by only one major producer, Cleveland-Cliffs New Energy Department rules to improve transformer efficiency will require switching to even more specialized and costlier amorphous steel. Add to that a shrinking labor force that can build and install this specialized hardware. The EPA's architects apparently believe there's a magic wand to fix all this. EV advocates at the EPA suggest that these mandates will induce market forces that will solve the attendant challenges. Dream on. Those were my words. That's a novel and dubious theory of innovation. Some behavioral changes might help, such as rationing access to EV charging or reducing the number of cars. Perhaps that's the real goal. Whatever the motivation, the EPA's de facto EV mandate is another green fantasy. Jonathan Lesser and Mark Mills with a piece that appears in the Wall Street Journal. Can we power the EPA's EV fantasy? All right, got a number of people online who want to talk about several topics today. We'll get to them in just a bit, but right now we're going to do a little bit of business with you as feedback continues in just a bit. Stay with us.
Serving Collegeville, North Wales, King of Prussia, and all of Montgomery County. This is News Talk 830 WEEU.
And now back to feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and Beyond.
Welcome back to Feedback on this Friday morning. Don't forget, we've got Berks County Commissioner Chairman Christian Leinbach coming in here during the 10 o'clock hour, and he'll be taking your questions right here on Feedback. All right, with that said, let's go to the phones right now. Let's head to Moton and speak with Dave this morning. Dave, good morning. Welcome to Feedback.
Good morning, Bill. How are you?
I'm fine. And yourself?
Hanging in there. Beautiful day.
I wouldn't happy know. I'm in a room that has no windows.
Oh, happy Good Friday.
Happy Good Friday to you, too.
Beautiful out. Listening to what you're saying, and I have had these thoughts many times. I think I might have mentioned one to you one time, but you know, they say about the environment, you know, with these battery vehicles. If you want to do something to change the environment, then let's stop cutting trees down for firewood. You know, that for people to heat their homes.
Well, just imagine how many trees are going to have to be cut down now to make these larger, heavier poles to be able to handle the heavier transformers.
Well, there's a lot to that, too. But also, you know, if you want to really change the environment quickly, let's stop building these huge houses that require three times the amount of energy to heat them and cool them. You know, that's going to be coming. You watch. That's in the near future. They're going to start limiting to the size house you can build.
Well, I have noticed, and you make a good point there, because all the new homes that I see going up are huge houses that are $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 each. And do we really need homes that are that big?
I promise you they could change this environment. They stopped cutting trees down. They limited the size of building, the houses that they're building, and you want to really stop it, they tell everybody to shut their air conditioning off.
That's probably coming in the not-too-distant future, buddy. We'll be told if we don't have brownouts and blackouts because we're of our dependence on green energy sources that are totally unreliable, it'll be some other mandate that'll tell us when we can use our air conditioning.
Don't stick the back end of your air conditioner and feel the heat that comes off your air conditioner.
Oh, that's a good point.
How many air conditioners are running, how much heat we're pumping into the environment every day.
Yeah, that's true too.
Especially in the cities.
Yep, you know, I agree.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're raising the temperature of the air, you know, just through the day, just running the air conditioners. So
we'll have to see. I mean, I'm really concerned about the future and what the government is going to be mandating in the not-too-distant future.
I just saw a commercial on TV for an EV that I'd actually consider. I think it was Honda. They have a new one out that charges itself as you drive it. And I've been waiting for this. There's no reason that can't be done.
Why can't we rely on hybrids? I have to ask that because people seem to be more accepting of hybrids than EVs.
That too, but that could also be, I think, combined with this car. But they said you don't have to plug it in ever; it charges itself as you drive it. And I was an industrial electrician. I know that's completely possible to do.
Well, Toyota Prius. I own two Priuses for a number of years, and they do the same thing. They will recharge their battery while you're driving, especially when you hit the brake. That will help to recharge the battery. I don't understand why that technology can't be used in EVs. If they're not already.
Well, apparently this new one that Honda has come out with, and it's reasonable. It said you can rent it, or I guess lease it for like $326 a month or something like that. That's really not outrageous. It's not that bad.
Well, I'm sure as time goes on, Dave, the technology is going to improve and the prices of these EVs will come down, and they'll figure out how to get greater mileage out of these batteries.
Well, I don't know. All I know is I'm glad I don't live in California looking at buying a hamburger from McDonald's for $20. So.
Amen to that, brother. All right, Dave, thanks for calling in, and you have yourself a happy Easter, okay?
All right, you too. Take care.
All right, bye-bye now. And Jim in Stony Creek wants to weigh in on Dave's comment about heat from ACs. Jim, good morning.
Hey, Bill, how are you?
All right, how are you doing today?
It is a salubrious day, as Jack Oakham would say.
I love it.
Yeah. So the gentleman was saying about the heat coming off of the heat pumps and the air conditioners. So if you go to one of these solar panel fields, and what do you think the temperature changes on that field? I mean, if you were to take a temperature reading from like up in Fleetwood, there's a big solar panel field now. If you would have taken a temperature from that field 5 years ago versus now, you know, you have all these black solar panels. That hot, that has to be a hot spot of 40, you know, if you were to, from space to take a reading, I'll bet you it's 40, 50 degrees hotter than it was 5 years ago. You know, so that argument I don't think holds any water because we're creating our own problems by putting solar farms in.
Yeah, that's a good point, too.
You know, and then the next problem I see is, you know, so now you've created a hot spot on Earth because of the solar panel farms. That heat goes straight up. Is that going to change climate control? You know, is that going to have climate change issues? Is that going to start tornadic activity? Because now all of a sudden you're going to get a hot spot in the atmosphere. I mean, those are all things that, you know, are other questions that nobody seems to want to touch.
Yeah, that you're making some very good points there.
And he said about cutting trees down for firewood. Most people that are cutting firewood are not cutting trees that are up anyhow. Most of the trees are already down. You know, most of the people I know that are heating with firewood are heating with ash, and all the ash trees have to be taken down anyhow because the ash borer beetles are killing the trees. So they're protecting the environment and protecting your electric lines because they're cutting these trees down so they don't fall on your electric lines.
Yeah, I have to wonder. I mean, I am not an advocate of warehouses. Why not use the space that you build a warehouse on and make it into a tree farm and use that to try and absorb some of the carbon dioxide in the air? We definitely need more trees, no doubt about it.
Or if you're gonna have a solar farm, put it on top of the warehouse roof. You know, don't take away farmland. Like up in Fleetwood, they took away, you know, prime farmland to make a solar farm. That should have never been allowed. I cannot believe the supervisors of the municipality up there ever allowed that to go through. That should have never been approved, you know.
No, but you raise, I mean, again, regardless of where you put those solar panels, you're right. That is going to be heat that's coming off of those panels and heating up the atmosphere above.
Exactly. You know, but nobody wants to talk about that. And that's what, you know, that kind of bugs me because, you know, everything's like, oh, we'll do this. But they don't look at they're not looking down the road to see what the adverse effects are of all this stuff. You know, solar panels are great, you know, except for they're hard to recycle when they go bad. You know, and then I guess I saw something on Facebook, so I don't know if it's, I don't take everything I see on Facebook to truth, but apparently there was a hailstorm or something that wiped out a whole solar panel field. So, and that's, you know, whether it happened or not, that is a possibility that it could happen. So when it happens, who eats that expense? You know, does the taxpayer now have to, you know, pay to replace all these solar panels?
Well, I would think that if it's connected to a utility, those that pay the electric bills, that would fall back on them again, thanks to the PUC saying that utilities can pass their infrastructure costs onto their consumers.
Right.
You know, I remember a number of years ago when the Limerick power plant, the Limerick nuclear power plant, went up in Montgomery County. A large number of people were concerned about the steam coming up from those towers at the time and what that would do to the local environment. Well, where's the outcry of things like what you're saying, Jim, on how these solar panels would impact the upper atmosphere?
I think people are just so ignorant they don't think about that stuff. They don't think of the long-term effects of a lot of these things. You know, it's just like, you know, it's just like the wind turbines. You know, they have all these wind turbines up in the coal region, you know, and they got piles of dead birds, you know, around all these wind turbines. You know, so the environmentalists are on one hand saying, oh, wind turbines are great, or, you know, but then they don't want to say anything about all the dead birds laying next to them.
Yeah, that's true. All right, Jim, thanks for weighing in today. I got to go, but thanks for your call today.
Right.
All right, bye-bye now.
Have a happy Easter.
Thank you. You do the same now. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Dave in Danielsville, unfortunately, buddy, I'm out of time, and I've got Commissioner Linebach coming in during the 10 o'clock hour. So if you want to call back in at 11, I'll take your call, and we can talk about your issues regarding voting. But I'm fresh out of time now, unfortunately. I wish there were a way to stretch out time, but you can't do it. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be back with the final seconds of hour number one of Feedback in just a bit.
Serving Bethel, Hamburg, Birdsboro, and all of Berks County. This is News Talk 830, WEEU.
enjoy this day, okay? And we're going to take a break right now for news with Radio PA and ABC. And Bob McCool will check in with the latest in sports for you. And it's opening day for the Phils. I'm all dressed in my red today in anticipation of that. Can't wait. I love baseball. I always love it when the baseball season starts. All right, we'll take a break here. We'll take a break. Maybe I should go get a donut. I know, we do have donuts here in the studio, by the way. So tempted. But anyway, we'll take the break. We'll be back in just a bit, so stay with us here.
And now back to Feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU. The voice of Berks and Beyond.
Better make tracks fast on the double. The girl's jazzy, but she's nothing but trouble.
Welcome back as we kick off hour number two of this Friday edition of Feedback, your on-air town square, here on the voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Saunders. Mike Keller is serving as my producer today, and I thank him for doing the double duty today as he's answering phones over there. Speaking of which, our numbers here are 610-374-8800 or toll-free 888-401-0459. And now you can text your opinion to us at 484-650-3373. And I'm very honored to have as my guest during the next hour, Berks County Commissioner Chairman Christian Leinbach is in the studio with us here, and he's going to be taking your questions today. Christian, good morning. Welcome to Feedback.
Great to be here, especially opening day for the Philadelphia
Absolutely.
Phillies.
Absolutely.
Opening day plus one, sort of, because it was supposed to be yesterday, but anyhow, it starts today.
I saw you wearing your Phillies jacket when you came in today, and you can see I'm decked out in red and a little bit of blue.
You got it.
But we've got a lot to talk about today,
and
I want to start. I wasn't going to start with this, but you heard some of the conversation that we had in the previous hour about solar panels and the solar power farm in Fleetwood. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that?
Well, you're right. We talked a little bit about this. One of the big issues is that the technology is ahead of the municipal planning. And as a result, some of these, and these are large scale, so
Okay. We're
not talking about somebody putting solar panels up on their business to run their business, solar panels on their home. We have a number of farms that have solar panels up for their farm operation. These are exclusively operations that in many cases are 100 acres or more.
Wow.
And they are 5 megawatts and larger, and they are exclusively designed to generate power and sell it back to the grid. In many cases, these are not your First Energy, MedEd, PPNL. They
mm-hmm.
don't, many of them no longer produce power. There are other third-party companies that are selling that power. And what has happened across Pennsylvania, and I was in a workshop probably 3-4 weeks ago with Penn State, where they said this is very similar to what happened in the early days of Marcellus Shale gas,
mm-hmm.
where the discovery was made, the gas companies were coming in. Many were responsible, but not all of them were.
Okay.
And taking advantage of the lack of regulation in the early days. And that has happened. I'm not saying that's exactly what's going on in Fleetwood, but I will tell you this. I know the neighboring farm, the Kurtz farm.
Mm-hmm.
They have had major issues, not just with storm water runoff, but fouling the aquifer so that the one farm, it's two brothers, the one farm's well is not usable.
Oh,
and
wow.
We have been, the Berks County Conservation District has been working with DEP and the Kurtz family. It's very frustrating. But the good news is that the County of Berks, through the Planning Department, has provided a very good white paper, for lack of a better word, to municipalities on things they really need to be doing now. You can't wait until a proposal comes in and then try to change zoning, change the rules. You're not going to be able to do that because of the way the law works. We need to try to get ahead of it. I have some challenges, and I heard one of your callers and concerns relative to solar. But right now, instead of getting into that, it's the challenge of understanding that right now there's work that needs to be done at the municipal level and possibly even at the state level.
Mm-hmm.
And municipalities know that. I'm not being critical of them. They were kind of caught short, and all of a sudden, grid-scale solar came onto not just Berks County but across Pennsylvania, and many, many municipalities weren't ready for it. One additional thing, solar on warehouse roofs. Most of the warehouses that are constructed to the minimum standard to deal with snow load.
Okay.
And as a result, cannot handle solar panels. There's not much I point to New Jersey and say, hey, they got it right. And it just, New Jersey is way too regulated for me.
Right.
But their warehouses, and I don't know how far back this rule goes, they have to be built so that they can carry the weight of solar panels. And the reason that's important, whether you support them or not, if you're putting solar panels on a roof, that's already an area that's been covered over by construction.
Mm-hmm.
Versus putting solar panels in the middle of farmland or taking down a forest, it makes a lot more sense. Now, it takes a lot more to get the number of acres. And 800,000 square foot warehouse cannot even come close to grid level. You need to be able to go and connect a number of warehouses in order to get enough solar to put up for grid level solar. And again,
wow.
Grid level is solely for the purpose of selling the solar, the power that's generated from solar energy back to the electric grid.
Now, I want to get your take on this because I know that this county takes great pride in farmland preservation. So with that said, what is your personal opinion of using farmland for solar farms?
So first of all, right now under current law, any farms preserved under the Pennsylvania Ag Preservation Program cannot accept large-scale solar. The only solar you can put on those farms would be solar that the farm is using to electrify, not electrify, but to run electricity for the farm or the home, but not grid solar. So
okay.
That's number one.
Okay.
There is some pressure to allow farms to do that. I absolutely oppose that. I think that that is not the purpose for preserving ag land. And we've been very clear. It's about production agriculture. And you can call it a farm, but solar is not farming. They didn't plant these miniature panels in the ground and watch them grow. I just think that is absolutely wrong. Number two, if land is in Clean and Green, and Clean and Green is a program not unique to farms, you need 10 acres or more. There is an exception if you're under 10 acres, but you generate $2,000 or more of retail sales off of that property, you can also qualify. The problem there is if it's in Clean and Green and the solar farm is approved and placed, all that happens is there's a penalty, a 7-year rollback of taxes that has to be paid. So it is not a prohibition against solar. It's just there's a penalty to do it. A farm that is not preserved, that's a whole different story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I believe it's very important that municipalities work closely with one another, work with their state association. The Township Supervisors Association is also working on this, and also work with our Berks County Planning Commission. We are willing to support in any way that we can. We have no authority to tell a township what they can and can't do, but we are there to support them.
Back to the a comment that you made earlier regarding the Fleetwood farm and the impact that it's having on the neighboring farm. Is there proof either through the DEP or elsewhere that what has happened to that neighboring farm's well is in fact the result of the solar panels on the other farm?
I'm not aware of anyone questioning that is the cause.
Okay.
They've been able to observe the stormwater runoff is crystal clear and didn't occur beforehand. It has to do with construction schedules, et cetera. But is also true the aquifer. The one farm uses 5,000 gallons of water a day, dairy and other operations. And it's been a nightmare. They actually, last year, drilled a second well to try to see if they could get beyond that problem. They were not able to do that. And again, DEP is involved in that, along with Berks County Conservation District. But we've got to be very careful. I'm not ready to blame the supervisors in Richmond Township for that. I really believe this is an example of where the technology is ahead of the regulatory environment, and we need to work to get that caught up so that we protect our communities.
So it's a lot like artificial intelligence. Well, we've got a long way to go to get our laws brought up to speed with things like artificial intelligence.
There's a lot of things. Technology has a tendency all of a sudden explode on the scene.
Right.
And then people are asking questions. Well, what about this? How do we handle this? And we can stick our heads in the sand, or we can say, okay, we have what we have. Let's figure it out. And in my opinion, protect liberty, number one. And number two, protect our community, our people, our environment, et cetera.
The commissioners held another meeting off-site last night in Muhlenberg Township, was it?
Muhlenberg, hosted by Muhlenberg Township, are on the road. We do that once a quarter.
And how was last night's meeting?
Went very well. We had the chair of the commissioners, Mike Malinowski, there. Every time we do this, we ask the hosting municipality to speak at the beginning of the program. Mm-hmm. He introduced some of the other commissioners. Some people may say, what's he talking about, commissioners? I thought townships have supervisors. Well, not if you're a first-class township.
Right. Uh-huh.
They are one of, I believe, three.
Okay.
So they have five township commissioners. I believe three of them were there last night. They had their township manager, their chief of police, one of their patrolmen. But it was a good program, and myself, along with Commissioner Santoni and Commissioner Rivera, were glad to participate.
How about public turnout? How was that?
Public turnout for on the road isn't that significant. There were a handful of people.
Okay.
But it's, for me, it is more about us doing two things. One, getting out into the community and highlighting our various municipalities. And I want to continue to do this. We highlight it by being there, but it also gives them an opportunity to highlight their municipality as part of our official meeting. The second thing is we do these at 7 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
Our normal meeting is Thursday at 10 a.m. A lot of people are working and not able to watch or get alone drive into the city and park and come up to the 13th floor. So it's an opportunity for the public to participate and for us to connect with different parts of our community. I do know it takes a number of our staff, and I will recognize our IS staff. They have to make sure that everything is set up for a hybrid meeting.
All right.
Because
okay.
Even though we're on the road, we still are broadcasting through Microsoft Teams Live event.
Mm-hmm.
BCTV carries that feed live, and then we are also broadcasting live on Facebook and YouTube Live.
Oh, so, wow. So when's your next town hall style meeting?
I don't have it in front of me. I believe it's in June.
Okay.
We'll see where that is. Our next town hall proper is going to be on April 20th at the Exeter Community Library, and both of my colleagues will be there. It's not likely I will be there, and so people, and I've been very open about this because people will wonder, where is he? What's going on? I tentatively have a total knee replacement scheduled for April the 9th, and so it's not likely that I will be there on the 20th. But my colleagues can handle that.
As one who did a hip replacement surgery, I know exactly where you're coming from there. So we wish you a speedy recovery, by the way.
Well, thank you, Bill. Appreciate that.
And we're in the process now of debating whether you're going to be with us the end of April as a result of that.
Right now we're keeping it on the schedule.
Uh-huh.
At the very least, I can call in, but I'm hoping that I'm able to drive by that point and come in and see the great feedback studio where it all happens, all the magic. Although I was a little disappointed.
What's that?
Where are the donuts?
Oh, I'll get you one.
No, this body doesn't need a donut, but I heard Mike this morning, and it all sounded very good. I go with the maple glazed donut. Just sounds great.
Believe me, I hope that your recovery is a lot better than mine was with my hip that took me what seemed like forever.
Well, thank you.
But that's a whole different matter there. Our guest this morning is Berks County Commissioner Chairman Christian Leinbach. He's with me for the full hour today, and we invite your questions here, 610-374-8800 or toll-free, 888-401-0459. Got a lot more to talk with the commissioner about, and we will do that right after this commercial break. Thank you for making us part of your day today.
Serving Paoli, Glenmore, Coatesville, and all of Chester County. This is News Talk 830, WEEU.
And now back to feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and beyond.
Welcome back to Feedback on this Friday morning. Our phone numbers here are 610-374-8800 or toll-free, 888-401-0459. As my guest for the remainder of this hour is Berks County Commissioner Chairman Christian Leinbach, and he's taking your questions today. And Christian, I understand there's an event coming up that you're going to be going to right after the show here.
Yes.
Share with us what that's all about.
Vietnam Veterans of America, Chapter 131, Berks County, is hosting a special event up at Veterans Grove at City Park at the Vietnam Memorial at 11 o'clock. And it's called Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans. One of the statements they have on their flyer is never again will one generation of veterans abandon another. I know a lot of these folks, men and women, great, great people. If you have an opportunity, come on out to City Park. It's today. It starts at 11 a.m. And like you said, that's where I'm headed to once I finish up here right around 11 o'clock. But we need to support our men and women that are, in essence, when they sign up, whether in peacetime or in war, it doesn't matter. They sign their name. They are literally signing their name in blood because they are saying, if it's necessary, I'm willing to pay the price, even to the point of giving my life. And many, many have done just that.
And it's a beautiful day weather-wise.
Oh, it is.
For that
beautiful
too.
Day for
yeah,
it.
Absolutely. I saw in the paper this morning that the county is moving ahead with a youth shelter. Share with us the background here, because I understand that there is a shortage of space for sheltering youth today.
Yeah, yes, and there are two issues here, and we want to be very careful. Earlier in the year, we passed an emergency declaration around youth detention.
Mm-hmm.
And youth detention deals with adjudicated, criminally charged youth.
Okay.
And that is an enormous problem across the Commonwealth, a lack of bed space. But in particular here in Berks, I think most people remember last summer, Abraxas Academy in Southern Berks, they had a riot earlier in the summer. Mm-hmm. Then nine of the residents escaped. Those residents, some of them were placed there by Berks County, some that escaped were placed by Lehigh County, some were placed by Dauphin County. The emergency declaration allows us to move forward very quickly with the youth detention center and repairs that are necessary. Those are already underway because of that emergency declaration. Youth shelter is different. Youth shelter primarily comes through our children and youth arena. In many cases, there are mental health issues, and these are children that, I hate to use the word abandon, but they have no place, no one to take them in. In the last couple of years, on two occasions, we've had youth end up in the Reading Hospital ER for months. because there was no place for them to go.
Oh, wow.
When we do find places, in some cases, we're paying between $1,000 and $5,000 a day.
Oh, my.
To place these young people. And it is absolutely not working. We've been working with the Commonwealth, the Department of Human Services, and our internal folks. And recently, about a week ago, we were approved for funding for the program.
Mm-hmm.
And we announced last evening, that we are moving forward with the hiring process. Now, this facility will be on the third floor of what is formerly known as the Berks County Residential Center.
Okay.
That's where we were contracted with ICE. It will now handle children. We have to put staff in place. We need a certain number of staff in order to open that.
Mm-hmm.
Also this week, the Department of Human Services was in to inspect for our license. Everything was a green light on that. So we're working to move forward. There is a cost involved, but in the end, we're hopeful that it is break even, maybe even a little bit better than break even. When you look at the enormous cost that we've been spending trying to do one-off solutions, we're estimating about 20 youth minors to be at this facility, and they will get education. It will be a good facility. But that's what was announced last night. Opening, it's hard to say. It's going to depend on hiring.
Okay, gotcha.
And so that could be as early as late June, early July, but it may be pushed into the end of the summer, beginning of fall, depending on our ability to hire staff.
And you mentioned that there is cost involved. Do you have a rough estimate as to what that cost would be?
It's difficult to give you a determination because there's upfront costs. The state is providing approximately $3.5 million to help us get this up and running.
Okay.
But then the other cost, we have to match that up against what we're already paying.
Mm-hmm.
And do we end up paying more or a little bit less? That remains to be seen.
Okay. And where does the detention center stand for?
The detention center construction work is being done right now. Dolan Construction is doing the work on repairs from water damage from a year and a half ago when some pipes froze in the building. And that gets us ready, once they're done, to be able to go into the next phase of construction for youth detention.
Okay. When Governor Shapiro announced as part of his budget plan, he also announced an education plan that looks like it's going to have an impact on Reading Area Community College. And at the time that the specifics came out, you voiced concern about that. Can you share with us what your concerns are about his plan?
Absolutely. And I made this clear every single time. I know the political environment that we're in. My comments that I'm about to make are not an attack on the governor, and they are not partisan. They are all about defending what I believe we have in an amazing institution in the Reading Area Community College. When you look at what RAC has done for this community, and in particular for students, it is absolutely incredible. And here's the problem. And I have the blueprint in front of me that the governor released. Right at the top, it says, as colleges grow more expensive and enrollment is dropping, and then it goes on and talks about why we need this. Well, number one, the most affordable college education in Berks County is Reading Area Community College, a little over $6,000 a year. You can't touch that in any other place.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, our enrollment isn't dropping, it's increasing, and some classes have significant backlogs of students waiting to get in, but there are not enough seats in those particular classes. One of them is the RN program. So right out of the gate, I'm saying, wait a minute, just because some other college is dealing with this, you're saying we need a change when none of these issues are issues for Reading Area Community College. So when you look at what they're proposing, there's two big issues that are being raised, not just by myself, but by many community college presidents, and in some cases by Pashi schools. So here's the proposal. The proposal is to take the Pashi, that's the state higher ed system.
The Penn State's, Miller's.
Not Penn State. Penn State
okay.
is in a class by itself.
Okay.
Millersville, Kutztown, Westchester, Bloomsburg, Cheney State, and a number of others.
Okay.
Those are the ones that come to mind.
Okay.
And merge those with the 15 community colleges across the Commonwealth. Now, there's a couple problems. Number one, community colleges and a traditional higher ed are not the same. An example would be Kutztown University, good school. Reading has an articulation agreement that anyone going from RAC, all of their credits transfer. Not only that, they have Kutztown at RAC for some higher ed programming. So there's a great relationship. However, Kutztown is primarily dorm students. So their students come from all over, not even just Pennsylvania, even outside of Pennsylvania. RAC has no dorms. We are a community college. Mm-hmm. Where can you see that? The percentage of student population at Kutztown that is Latino is 3.4%. The percentage of Latino students at RAC are 43%. Now, does that mean that there's something amiss at Kutztown? No, it doesn't.
Right.
It's the difference between a community college and a traditional higher ed. A higher ed is drawing from a wide area, so it's not going to be reflective of the community. A community college is reflective of the community, and that makes sense in a city that's almost 70% Latino. But here are the two enormous problems. In the blueprint, in the FAQ, there's a section called Frequently Asked Questions. And so the first issue, we keep being told it's not a merger. But listen to this. Does the governor intend to merge Pennsylvania's community colleges into the Pashi system? No. The community colleges will not be merged into Pashi. But listen what it says. Rather, the intent is to create an entirely new public post-secondary system with a new governance structure, and the community colleges and the Pashi universities will be equal partners in the system. That's a merger.
Yeah, certainly.
That's a merger.
Right.
It's kind of funny. Normally when you hear about businesses merging, mm-hmm. it's not a merger. One business bought the other business, but they say merger to make all the employees feel good. It's not like I'm being taken over by this one or that one.
Right.
In this case, they're saying it's not a merger, and it's exactly what a merger is. Neither one is going to be in charge. They're creating a new system. We believe, many of us that support the position that I do, is you move ahead with this and you're taking community out of community colleges.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no way. And here's the bigger issue, and it has to do with governance. And this is right out of the blueprint. Community colleges are currently overseen by local governing boards appointed by the local sponsor, either a city, a county, or a set of school districts. RAC, the county, is the sole sponsor. Will the creation of a new system require local boards to be dissolved altogether? That's a clue. There is going to be a major change in the leadership and control of community colleges. And the question, altogether dissolved? Here's the answer. No. Governor Shapiro has stated explicitly that his goal is to retain an element of local governance. Exactly how local governance will function under a new system is yet to be determined. Now, let me give one bit of credit to the governor. The governor was here visiting RAC several weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Commissioner Rivera and I both made a point to be there. I spoke to the governor and shared with him these concerns.
Okay.
And shared them saying, look, I'm not attacking you, but this is wrong. For RAC, this is not helpful. to his credit, at his press conference, and I was not in the press conference, I sat in front because I don't stand with this the blueprint concept, he acknowledged both of these concerns, and he acknowledged that they are our concerns at Reading Area Community College. On Monday, the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania is hosting a call with the governor's office, along with county leaders from counties that have community colleges, and we will be sharing the same information with them again. I'm hopeful that in the end, common sense will prevail, and schools like RAC will continue to operate with their great leadership, Dr. Looney, the Board of Trustees, the RAC Foundation, the work that they do, and our staff. My understanding is a lot of our staff aren't interested in becoming part of a statewide union. They much prefer to stay in the local control with people that know and understand the work that they do. And I think this is all vitally important. But at the end of the day, it's about the students we serve.
Right.
And I don't know how the cost of an education won't go up if you merge us in with systems that all cost tens of thousands of dollars more a year than what RAC costs today.
My guest this morning is Berks County Commissioner Chairman Christian Leinbach. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more with the commissioner in just a bit. Stay with us.
I'm terrific. I'm the best. I stand out from all the rest. And next to you, I'm even better.
Serving Myerstown, Fredericksburg, Newmanstown, and all of Lebanon County. This is News Talk 830, WEEU.
The voice of Berks and Beyond.
Welcome back to Feedback. Again, my guest is Berks County Commissioner Chairman Christian Leinbach, who's with me for the rest of the hour. And Christian, there's coverage in the news today about a passenger rail service that is being proposed for the Lehigh Valley area, and that seems to be causing some confusion as it relates to the passenger rail service that we're looking at here. Can you address that here today?
Sure. That's a very different scenario. Two big things. One, the proposal or study looked at several different routes. The three main were Allentown to New York, Allentown to Philadelphia, and Allentown to Reading. So we're dealing with one route, and it is Allentown to New York via Philadelphia, Amtrak type line.
Okay.
The second, and this is the enormous issue, I looked at the different costs for each of the lines. I think on average it's like $460 million in capital costs up front. And the reason is none of these lines are fully intact. There are either abandoned lines or areas where there's no line and they have to put that line into place. There's a tremendous cost for the Lehigh Valley simply to get the infrastructure in. The Schuylkill River Passenger Rail Authority line is not only fully in place and intact, it is up to specification for passenger rail. So it's a matter of negotiating with Norfolk Southern, with SEPTA. Those are the two main lines, Norfolk Southern from here to Norristown, SEPTA from Norristown to Philadelphia. There are some alternates at Norristown. Could bring in CSX for a mile.
Okay.
But again, that track is there. It's fully operational and completely up to spec. So there's really no comparison. They're talking 10 to 12 years minimum for that line up in the Lehigh Valley. We're looking at probably 5 years realistically.
Mark sent me a text message. He didn't let me know where he's from, but Mark sent me a text message that says this. Just this week, Lancaster Airport announced scheduled flights from Lancaster to Orlando, Florida. Is there still a possibility that Reading's airport could get a similar type of service in the near future?
Yes, there is. That service that was announced is through Breeze. It's a regional airline. We have had discussions and continue to discuss the possibility of commercial air service. I will point out Boscov's continues to do charter
right.
out of the airport mm-hmm. through Southwest Airlines. A lot of people don't realize that. So if you want to fly to Orlando, check with Boscov's. They can give you that schedule. But, yes, we are continuing to look at commercial air service out of the Reading Regional Airport.
I want to ask you a few questions related to elections.
Sure.
In your prior meeting, March 21st, you made the comment, or at least the minutes of the meeting say that you made the comment there that the ballots at the time couldn't be mailed out due to not knowing who will be on the ballot in the Senate race. Now, that's been resolved now, has it not?
That's been resolved as of a week ago today.
Was that just the Republican side where there were two candidates who were one the court dropped and the other one dropped out of the race, or
this
was
is,
it both?
This
was
is
it both
one
parties?
That the court dropped.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so now those ballots are ready to go out?
Those ballots should be going out next week.
Okay.
They're being worked on, printed, and readied for mailing next week.
And House Speaker Joanna McClinton from Philadelphia made the announcement last week that she wants to see same-day voter registration and a two-week early voting period here. What's your take on that?
My take is we shouldn't be making more changes. We should be fixing the problems we already have. I read things like that and say, "What are you talking to your county election department?" We just had a decision this week from the Third Circuit Federal Appeals Court that undated absentee and mail-in ballots do not count. This issue is an issue because the law, Act 77, is somewhat ambiguous. It says the outer envelope shall be signed and dated, but the legislation doesn't say what the date is. The courts in Pennsylvania ruled in and jumped in and ruled initially Commonwealth Court that you have to count them even if they're undated. Then months later in 2022, the Supreme Court said, no, you can't count them, but the date has to be within this range. Last year, the Western District Court said, no, you have to count the undated ballots. That was appealed to this decision, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and now they're saying you can't count them. This needs to be fixed, and the mm-hmm. legislature needs to work on that. In addition to that, they need to say if the date is necessary, and I question whether it is or isn't, but if the date's necessary, what date goes there?
Right.
Don't leave it wide open. Mm-hmm. Additionally, the current law does not allow a county to, A, have a process to verify the signature on the outside of the envelope, and, B, it specifically bars a county from rejecting a mail-in ballot because of the signature on the outside. If you look at issues like voter ID, we need voter ID in Berks County in Pennsylvania. If you look at some of the other issues, letting people register for an application 7 days before the election, hundreds of ballots do not count every election since Act 77 because they come in too late. They come in after 8 p.m. on election day. We need that date moved back to 14 days. That's something the County Commissioners Association supports. They need to be fixing what's wrong now. And there have been virtually no changes in the election law since the general election of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to make new changes. Fix what we have, get it corrected, and then if you want to talk about some of this other stuff, we can.
County Commissioner Christian Leinbach, Chairman of the Board of Commissioners, is my guest this morning. Christian, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming in today.
Thank you, Bill. It's always a pleasure to be with you, the Feedback audience, and WEEU.
And I want to wish you a happy Easter and all the best with a speedy recovery on your upcoming surgery.
Absolutely. Happy Easter to you. Happy Passover and Easter to all of our listeners.
Christian Leinbach with me today, and we'll be back with the final seconds of hour number two of today's edition of Feedback in just a bit. Stay with me.
I'm terrific. I'm the best. I stand out.
news, weather, and traffic.
It's a source I can trust.
A new generation of talk. News Talk 830 WEEU.
I know you think. And that does it for hour number two of today's edition of Feedback. You're on air Town Square. We're going to take a break for news with Radio PA and ABC and a check on sports with our own Bob McCool. And then we'll be back with the third and final hour of the show today, which I thank you for making part of your day today. Stay with us right here on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU.
And beyond.
Welcome back as we kick off the third and final hour of this Friday edition of Feedback. You're on air Town Square on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Saunders, and I'm so thankful Mike Keller is doing double duty today, serving as producer of Feedback today, as Sean Tansky is out again. Sean is going to be at the Citizens Bank Park today. He's one of the lucky ones who gets to watch the home opener for the Phillies today. I'm jealous, to be honest with you. But Sean will be back on Monday. And just to fill you in on some guests that we're going to have next week, on Monday, the 1st of April, Congresswoman Chrissy Houlihan, who represents parts of Berks and Chester counties in the 6th Congressional District, will be on Feedback on Monday at 11:30. And then on Wednesday, which is the 3rd of April, I'll be joined by State Senator Scott Martin, who chairs the Senate Appropriations Committee. He'll be here on Feedback at 9:30 on the morning of April 3rd. And then, of course, next Thursday and Friday, yours truly is taking off. So we will be running Best of Feedbacks next Thursday and Friday. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. My one listener out there. That was Mike Keller,
by
the way.
Favorite thing you've said so far today.
I'm going to come on Mornings with
Love
Mike
you.
Someday. Yeah. I'll bet. No, I really am thankful that he's filling in as a producer today. That
I'll
is what you're
your
doing.
Mind. I'll change your mind. Don't worry. I'll change your mind.
I thought you were going to say you're going to charge me.
Per call.
All right. By the way, speaking of calls, I want to apologize to all the people who were on hold who wanted to ask a question of Commissioner Chairman Christian Leinbach while he was here. We had so much that we wanted to address before we went to the calls that we just totally ran out of time. And again, my apologies to the people who were on hold waiting to address the questions. Typically, I like to come to you and have you ask the questions of the guests rather than it be me. But there were so many important things to get the commissioner's input on that we just totally ran out of time during the last hour. It's a shame he couldn't stay here. He had another event to go to. A more important event to go to, I might add, or I would have asked him to stick around for a little bit to take your calls in the next hour. Anyway, I want to talk a little bit. We've mentioned the president and his student loan forgiveness program, and a lot of people call in and they say, how can he continue to do this when the Supreme Court knocked him down when he first started doing this? Well, now there's an update to this. I got this from the Washington Examiner. Kansas and other GOP-led states are suing the Biden administration over its plans to continue canceling student loans. The president announced $144 billion in student loan forgiveness since his original plan was struck down, that is, by the Supreme Court, and devised a new plan to lower future payments that could cost taxpayers around $475 billion. Money that a private person borrowed in order to improve their education, that's now going to fall back on all of us to repay, rather than the person who took out the loan. Kansas Attorney General Chris Kobach announced back in February that he had planned to file suit, but did not provide an exact time frame for when that would happen. Well, now it is happening. His state and 10 others submitted their lawsuit yesterday in the United States District Court for the District of Kansas. Here's what the suit says, or at least a portion of it. Last time defendants tried this, the Supreme Court said that this action was illegal. It goes on to say nothing since then has changed other than introducing more legal errors into this rule's underlying analysis. Well, the suit, which names Biden, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona, and the Department of Education as defendants, sets up a second round of legal battles between red states and the Biden administration over student loans. Biden announced in August of 2022 a plan to forgive at least $400 billion in student loans in amounts of up to $20,000 per person. That plan was not approved by Congress, leading Kansas and other states to sue the Department of Education within weeks, arguing it was unconstitutional. Well, the Supreme Court agreed, striking the program down in a 6-3 ruling last June. Biden wasted little time attempting to work around that ruling, announcing that 804,000 borrowers would have $39 billion of their student debt transferred to the public debt just 2 weeks later. He's announced a steady trickle of new rounds since then, totaling around $144 billion and affecting 4 million borrowers. The original plan rested on the Higher Education Relief Opportunities for Students, or HEROES Act, of 2003 for its legal justification, while more recent moves rely on the Higher Education Act of 1965. But Kansas and the other states, which include Alabama, Alaska, Idaho, Iowa, Louisiana, Montana, Nebraska, South Carolina, Texas, and Utah, say the new plan is just as illegal. This lawsuit is now necessary to prevent defendants from continuing to flout the law, which includes ignoring Supreme Court decisions, according to this latest suit. An even bigger issue may be the Saving on a Valuable Education, or SAVE, plan, under which monthly student loan payments are as low as $0 for low-income borrowers, and loans can be written off completely after as little as 10 years. The SAVE plan, again, something else that was not approved by Congress, and similar to loan forgiveness, has generated controversy because any unpaid debts fall on the taxpayer. The Penn-Wharton budget model estimated that SAVE could cost $475 billion over 10 years. Biden has been explicit in his defiance of the high court. It goes on and on and on, but you get the gist here. So we'll see how this latest lawsuit shakes out, and whether it finally gets the president to stop doing a program that he really does not have the authority to do. Speaking of money, the federal government is sending $60 million in emergency funds to Maryland in regards to the destroyed bridge down there, the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Reuters says that Maryland officials say the emergency funds would support mobilization operations and debris removal, laying the foundation for a rapid recovery, and that the state may seek additional emergency funding as damage assessments progress. The governor is Wes Moore of Maryland, and he had requested the funding earlier on, and within hours, the U.S. Department of Transportation's Federal Highway Administration approved the request to fund emergency work. Well, there is a local congressman, I don't know if he was listening to this show or not, because I raised this question a few days ago, right after, the day after the president announced that the government was going to pick up the full tab of repairing the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Well, now Representative Dan Muser, who represents the 9th Congressional District here in Pennsylvania, which includes Lebanon and Schuylkill counties and parts of Berks County, I believe the northern part of Berks County. He criticized the president yesterday for pledging that the federal government will pay for the replacement of the bridge in Baltimore. Biden said the federal government will move heaven and earth to rebuild the bridge. The collapse has thrown East Coast shipping into chaos, shutting down the Port of Baltimore and severing Interstate 695. Well, here's what Muser said during an interview on Fox News with Maria Bartiromo, and I quote, "It was kind of outrageous immediately for Biden to express in this tragedy the idea that he's going to use federal funds to pay for the entirety of the bridge." He went on to tell Maria, "First reaction, frankly the only reaction, tends to be to spend." Well, Biden on Tuesday pledged to send Baltimore all the federal resources they need as we respond to this emergency, promising, and I quote again, "We're going to rebuild that port together." He said, "It's my intention that the federal government will pay for the entire cost of reconstructing that bridge, and I expect the Congress to support my effort," he said in remarks at the White House. Roll Call reported it's unclear how much a new bridge would cost or how long it would take to build. Federal officials told Maryland leaders on Wednesday that it could cost as much as $2 billion. Well, with that said, the Wall Street Journal says the legal battle is already underway regarding this catastrophe that happened there involving the Francis Scott Key Bridge. And here's what they're reporting. The first shot in the legal fight over who will pay for the damage and loss will likely occur in the next few days in a Baltimore courtroom, insurance academics told the Wall Street Journal. The Singaporean owner of the cargo ship that took down the bridge is expected to invoke a law dating back to the 19th century that limits the liability of ship's owners, according to Lawrence Brennan, a law professor at Fordham University in New York. And I shared that with you yesterday in a piece that I saw in USA Today. That law is similar to one used by the Titanic's owners after that unsinkable liner hit an iceberg. The Limitation of Liability Act is the law in question here. Caps the liability of the cargo ship's owners and their several insurers at the value of the goods the ship was carrying and the value of the ship itself. A representative of the ship's owner, which happens to be Grace Ocean, did not respond to a request for comment for this Wall Street Journal article. The fight, maritime lawyers say, could run as long as a decade. It'll be one of the most contentious marine insurance cases in recent decades, said Brennan, the law professor, and who happens to be a retired captain in the U.S. Navy, by the way. While the lawyers fight, most claims will likely get paid by the insurers, including money for the bridge reconstruction, so says the Wall Street Journal. Then they will duke it out among themselves. Other claims might take longer, including those by the families of the people killed in that crash. Other big sources of claims include the loss of revenue for the port, for the vessels now stuck inside it, and for businesses affected by the resulting supply chain snarl-ups. So it's just piling up as to what the total cost would be on this. The bridge part of this web of claims may be the simplest to resolve, reports the Wall Street Journal. The structure cost some $60 million to build back in 1977, which now, adjusted for inflation, would be around $300 million. I believe the USA Today article yesterday said in today's dollars it would be $360 million. Well, the bridge, and this is something I didn't know till I read this in the journal here, the bridge is covered by the state of Maryland's insurance. The policy covering property damage and business interruption for bridges and tunnels pays up to $350 million, documents show. The state, with its insurers in support, will likely be among many claimants that sue the Singaporean owner of the giant cargo ship that struck the bridge, seeking to recover their losses. So again, I have to ask, why did Mr. Biden step in and say the federal government will pick up the full tab here if this thing is insured, if Maryland has insurers who are covering the cost of that bridge? And it looks like if these figures are correct, and the final project, of course, we all know that estimates never work out to be the exact dollar figure when all is said and done here. But if they are correct, that today's dollars mean that the bridge would require $300 million to reconstruct, and Maryland's insurers will cover up to $350 million, then it seems like the full tab is there. You don't need federal money for this. So again, I've got to ask why. Well, maybe I do know why. It is an election year, after all, and aren't we out to buy as many votes as we can with taxpayer money? Of course we are. Who's kidding who? We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of Feedback in just a bit. Stay with us.
Serving Barnesville, Schuylkill Haven, Tremont, and all of Schuylkill County. This is News Talk 830, WEEU.
And now back to Feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and Beyond.
Everybody's got a problem, so do I. But we ain't gonna solve them on a Saturday night. I just put a paycheck in the bank. And I ain't hit the town in a minute to drink.
Dierks Bentley here on the voice of Berks and Beyond. 830 WEEU is Feedback. You're on air. Town Square continues. By the way, Doug in Redding heard the story about Kansas and other states that have filed a lawsuit against the president and the Department of Education and the Secretary of Education about this ongoing effort to forgive student loan debt after the Supreme Court struck down the president's initial effort, saying he didn't have the authority to do that without Congress. Well, Doug writes to me in a text message, "Hallelujah. Let's hope the lawsuit stops this huge government giveaway. I've paid all my loans." All right, thank you, Doug. I appreciate you weighing in on that. And with that, let's go to the phones. Matt in Chillingdon wants to weigh in on illegal immigrants flying to Detroit.
You're probably going to think your producer was just joking around, Bill, but he was not. I'll get to that as my main topic. But an update, you know, that USA Today article you cited yesterday, I went back and referred to it myself. I think you said, yes, rebuilding the Key Bridge would cost $316 million in today's dollars. So I went back and then I checked on the size of the bipartisan infrastructure bill passed by Congress and signed by the president. According to Forbes, the amount allocated for roads, bridges, and other major projects is $110 billion. So I then checked my calculator and found that when you divide $316 million by $110 billion, you get 0.0028. Rounding that up to 0.003, it means that replacing the Key Bridge in today's dollars, if that's the correct number, would require 0.3% of the money allocated for roads and bridges. And, Bill, what that did, it transported me back to Economics 101 in college, and I hope it does for you too, when the professor asked if we really understood how large $1 billion is. And to answer that question in the updated terms, we now know someone did win over $1 billion in the Mega Millions jackpot. So congratulations, Bill. I'm going to assume it was you. You won the billion, but you don't have to acknowledge it. However, instead of giving it to you all at once, the lottery will add a dollar a minute to your bank account nonstop. At the rate of a dollar a minute, 60 minutes an hour, 365 days a year, how long would it take the lottery to give you $1 billion at a dollar a minute? And, Bill, that is the same example I passed along to all of my economics classes when we began looking at government spending. I wouldn't even expect you to take a guess, Bill, but if you did, the answer, my friend, it would take approximately 1,900 years. That's right. 19 centuries to count a billion at a dollar a minute. And I couldn't finish it there, Bill, regarding our $34 trillion debt. That is expressed as a 34, oh my God, 34 followed by 12 zeros. Bill, you put that number down, it'll make you depressed. That's
now,
it did for me.
Now, before you go on, Matt, because on this note, I just took a look at the total U.S. national debt. Back in January, I believe it was January 4th, we hit the $34 trillion mark with that debt. It since that time, and it's just not even 3 months later, that debt has now grown by over $609 billion.
Unbelievable.
I mean, the debt can grow that fast, but your analogy of a dollar a minute, and it still didn't come out to that much.
And yeah, it's crazy when you get to there. And although I'll send you the source here, anybody with internet connection, just Google Matt Maddock, M-A-D-D-O-C-K. That's all it took for me after I first heard this story. He is a state representative from Michigan, Bill, and he wrote on social media on Wednesday night he had photo evidence of illegal invaders arriving at the Metro airport. He took pictures of a plane and pictures of three buses, and then he said, happening right now, three buses just loaded up with illegal invaders at Detroit Metro. Anyone have any idea where they're headed with their police escort? Well, Bill, airport authorities confirmed, yes, only one Allegiant plane landed in Detroit on Wednesday. It departed from Spokane, Washington. What was found, Bill, was that one plane contained the Gonzaga University men's basketball team, who are playing tonight in Detroit in the NCAA tournament. They arrived by plane. They did get a police escort. And you think someone would be a little humble when told about that? Here is Mr. Maddock's recent post. We know this is happening. Hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants are pouring into our country. Since we can't trust the fake news to investigate, citizens will. The process of investigating these issues will take time. So hard to believe sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction. But, Bill, I'm going to pursue this story. Did you hear anything about it? Supposedly on Wednesday, three busloads and a police escort came from the Philadelphia airport to the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Philadelphia. I'm very suspicious, especially when it said, Bill, five or six of those people on that bus were wearing Atlanta Braves caps. Watch out, my friend.
All right, Matt, who's going to win today?
Oh, man, it's going to be great to watch. Two great pitchers. I got to flip a coin, but I'll give the edge to the home team on this one.
There you go. It's going to be a wheeler day, no doubt about it.
Have a good weekend.
You too, Matt. Bye-bye now. All right, let's go to Muhlenberg and speak with Joe. He wants to talk about gas prices. Joe, hi. Welcome to the program today.
Good morning. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Earlier you talked about the fluctuating gas prices and you gave the reason why they go up one week and down the next. I'm trying to wrap my hands around that and figure out. You mentioned that one gas is a pollutant-free gas and another one is a different type of gas.
Well, the summer blend is what we were talking about versus the winter blend.
Yeah, well, what does that mean, actually? I mean, isn't gas gas? I mean, one gas is the same as the other, and
no, there's a refinery. There's a change, and I don't know. I'm not a chemist, but there's a difference in the makeup of the gasoline that is available during the summer months because of the heat. The federal government issued a ruling a long time ago. This isn't something new. Where the gasoline blends changes just as the summer season comes around. First of all, not only because of the hot weather, but also because of the number of cars that end up being on the road for vacation period and the like. So it's a way to try and further reduce the number of pollutants that end up in the air.
Yeah, I would guess that they would make the gasoline, you know, pretty much the same despite the seasons, you know, there's no reason why they can't do that. You know, it's just mind-boggling, you know, why it has to go up so much, you know, and it's not like it's a gradual hike. I mean, you'll go 1 week, you know, you'll go by and then the next it'll be 20, the next day it'll be, you know, 20, 30 cents higher than the previous day. You know, it's such a shocking thing. You know, especially with somebody who owns a business and they have like fleet cars and everything. You know, it's hard to budget when things like that happen.
Well, the other thing is the unrest in the rest of the world that's also causing the price of gasoline to go so high now. So it's not just the switch in blends in gasoline that's doing that.
Right. I understand. Well, it just seems a little confusing, you know. You know, why they can't just make a consistent blend rather than switching it, you know, due to the change of the seasons. But just curious.
In fact, you may even see, I know I do in my car, when you've got that shift in the blend, my gas mileage changes. And I can't recall if during the winter months, it's the summer months I get a better gas mileage than I do during the winter months because of that switch in the blends of the gasoline.
Yeah, you would think that you would switch it for the better, you know, to get better gas mileage, but just, you know, just even out the price between the two. I don't know. I'm not in the gas industry, so gas business. So it's a little confusing.
I'm with you. I hear you, buddy.
Okay.
Joe, thank you.
Take it easy.
You too.
Have a nice Easter.
You do the same. Bye-bye now.
See ya. Bye.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be back with more feedback on this Good Friday in just a bit. Stay with us.
Serving Tamaqua, Pottsville, Pine Grove, and all of Schuylkill County. This is News Talk 830 WEEU.
And now back to feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and Beyond.
That's Jason Mraz bringing us out of that commercial break here on The Voice of Berks and Beyond. News Talk, 830 WEEU. Ed in Wummelsdorf heard the conversation I had with Joe in Muhlenberg about the change in the gas blends. And in his text message to me, Ed says the gas blend has to do with California smog. So there you go. There's an answer for you as to why they changed the blends there. Ed, thank you. Appreciate the text message and the answer to our question. Let's go back to the phones. Pablo in Reading wants to talk about Easter. Hey, Pablo, good morning. Happy Good Friday to you.
Good morning. Just got a question. You know, you got that guy who's picking up the phone. I know he's part of the mafia because, you know, he came back. They kicked him out and they brung him back like the Godfather. You know what I mean? He scares me. All right. What I want to say.
Was there a question there regarding him? Did I miss that?
No. He knows what I mean. He's like the mafia. You know what I mean? He's the Godfather in the morning.
He's on the
those little things in his mouth and goes, I'm going to give you an offer you can't refuse. You know what I mean?
He's on the phone with another caller, so he's not hearing what you and I are saying.
That's okay. But listen, when this holiday came to be more about a bunny than Jesus.
Yeah, that was a question that we raised just the other day.
We did? Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
No, that's okay. Well, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, everywhere I go, I see everything about bunnies and this and eggs and chocolate bunny, chocolate chips, I mean, peeps and all this stuff, but nothing, I don't see really much about, you know, what is the day or the week or whatever is about. Jesus is God's son, Jesus. And I don't really don't see it. Then at this time of the year, 92% of Catholics don't go too much to church only in these times of the year, like Christmas, Palm Sunday, Good Friday, you know, and Passovers and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
Well, I think it's every denomination, not just the Catholic religion that's experiencing
too, but
that.
And sometimes it just throws me for a loop because, you know what I mean, when I go to the stores, I'm like, man, God, so much stuff, you know, pink bunnies and all this and that. But I was telling my nine-year-old, you know, this is about, you know, the birth of Jesus or, you know, the about Jesus. And then he goes, is that the same thing as God? I said, well, God is the father of Jesus. And then sometimes it's hard to explain to a nine-year-old and stuff because I'm not a priest or a beacon or, you know, all that kind of stuff. I'm not as knowledgeable as should I be and stuff like that to tell my son. You know what I mean? I talked to him about the birds and the bees already, but, you know, that part, I still lost a little bit in the sauce, I'd say.
Yeah, you know, there was a time, and many, many years ago, well, not many years ago, but it was a time when everybody knew when Easter came about. Now, it seems like when you talk to people and you say, oh, have a happy Easter, and they say, oh, is Easter coming up? Oh, you're right. It is Sunday, isn't it? It's not on the top of their mind anymore.
Yeah, I know it's on top of my mind because I'll be eating some ham and turkey that day, you know?
Oh, don't make me hungry now. I haven't had anything to eat since 6 this morning.
But you got a bunch of donuts there.
No, I don't eat sweets. I'm off of sweets, buddy.
Okay. Well, I'll eat one for you over here.
Thank you.
You have a nice Easter.
You do the same and enjoy the rest of your Good Friday, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Pablo, bye-bye. Thanks for the call. Bye-bye now. Let's go to Leesport and speak with Bob, who also wants to weigh in on Easter. Bob,
yeah,
good morning. Happy Good Friday.
Pablo. I feel for that brother there. You know, he's a little confused. And the Bible does say we are priests. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse, I believe it's around 9. You are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people that should show forth the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into his glorious light or marvelous light. I forget which word, but you know, that's what Easter is about. I'm not surprised that all you hear are peeps and baskets and eggs and stuff. That is a convenient way to avoid the real meaning, and it's part of marketing. It's part of the world's system of celebrating spring. It has nothing to do to them in their mind of what the real meaning of the holiday of Christ's resurrection is. And so, yeah, yesterday I was talking about Maundy Thursday and bringing that into light. It comes from the word, and that's from the Last Supper that Jesus had with his disciples. And mandatum is the word from which that term comes, and it means the command or the mandate in which Jesus, after he had washed his disciples' feet at supper, said, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you. I know in the Catholic Church that when the bishops wash the feet of the priests they are in charge of as a show of humility. But as believers in Christ, we should have that same attitude toward one another and to those that are not even believers. And, of course, Good Friday, this is the day when Christians celebrate Christ's crucifixion. It's not, you say, well, why would they celebrate something like that? Because Christians believe he took the rap for you. He took the rap for me. He died in our place. He paid the penalty of our sins on that cross. And as a result, we are free from not only the penalty, but also from the burden of having to continue to sin, but to be obedient to him. And then that comes to the resurrection day, which is Easter, the day. We recall that resurrection day was Christ's rising from the dead, as he had predicted. He said, as 3 days Well, we could get into a good conversation on that, but as 3 days and three nights, Jonah was in the belly of the whale, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the earth. And then he would rise again to give us the hope of eternal life. And that's what early Christians believed. If you read 1 Corinthians chapter 15, that's what the Apostle Paul says, I give you that which I also received when I first came. He says, I'm the least of the apostles because I persecuted the church. But when I came to faith, this is what was told to me. And he went out and preached to so many people that he was the greatest missionary throughout Europe and turned the Roman Empire upside down. And that's the power of the resurrection. That's the power of Christ in Christians to, even in the midst of a wicked or an evil government, they can make a difference.
Buddy, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And
I hope
and
you
have a happy Easter.
And you do
God
the same for you and your family as well, buddy, okay?
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye
God
now.
Bless. Bye.
All right, let's go to Mount Penn. Candy wants to weigh in on this loan forgiveness story we've been talking about. Candy, good morning. Welcome to Feedback. Candy, are you there? Candy, you got to be at your phone. Hello.
Hi. Sorry about that.
There we go. Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, are you taking off for the lunar eclipse?
No.
No. I think it what is on the 7th?
Yeah, it's on the 7th, but I'm taking off. My birthday is on the 4th of April.
Oh.
And
happy.
And yours truly never works on his birthday.
Oh, good for you. That sounds good. I was different places. I know where I used to work. You could get your birthday off, so that was kind of nice.
Yeah, that's been a golden rule of mine for my entire career is that I try not to work on my birthday as best I can. Pamper myself on that day.
Sure. I wanted to say about this, what they call student loan forgiveness. And, you know, I kind of think that maybe it's just an idea of mine. The government, I think they, you know, currently, every now and then you have people complaining about the high taxes that we have to pay,
mm-hmm.
and especially like the property tax and the school tax. I know here in Exeter Township, ours really went up. I think what they might be currently, you know, we have our public schools and you have grades 1 through 12. I think they want to extend that to grade 16.
Wow.
And I was listening recently to a radio station, a nearby radio station, and they were talking about how much our 10 top officials in our state are making. And there's one even in charge of like pensions and things like that, retirement plans, and all of them are making over $400,000 a year.
Oh my word!
So I mean, I think the budget as a whole, we really need to do some trimming.
I couldn't agree with you more, Candy.
Yeah,
no doubt about it.
And I was, you know, it's hard for me to imagine your previous caller, Matt, about how much really a billion is. It's kind of mind-boggling.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. And you say you're having somebody from next week on Wednesday, is it?
Next Wednesday I'm going to have the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee on with me. I believe it's at 9:30. I'll be joined by State Senator Scott Martin. He'll be with me from 9:30 to 10 o'clock next Wednesday morning. And I know that one of the things he wants to address is the governor's proposed budget.
Oh, okay. That should be a really interesting see what kind of a budget they had made out. I don't know if you want to call it a budget, but you have a happy Easter and happy birthday.
Thank you, Candy. Happy Easter and enjoy the rest of your Good Friday today, okay?
Thank you.
All right, thanks for calling. 610-374-8800, toll free, 888-471-0451. Did I say that right? 401-0459, something like that. You get to the point where it just comes off your tongue and you don't realize what you're saying there. Anyway, Matt was talking about immigrants a minute ago, and I think I have time to share this with you. This I got from the Washington Times. President Biden's wave of illegal immigrants is upending the usual demographics of immigration and sending education levels plummeting, according to a report that came out yesterday that raised big questions about the nation's ability to absorb the newcomers. The U.S. now has 13.7 million illegal immigrants and 51.4 million immigrants overall. That's an increase of 6.4 million in 3 years since Mr. Biden took office, according to the Center for Immigration Studies and their report they came out with yesterday. That averages 172,000 new immigrants each month, or roughly four times the rate during the Trump years and nearly three times the rate in the Obama years. Most of the new arrivals are from Latin America, and 3.7 million of the net new arrivals came illegally. Some 44% have no education beyond high school, and a significant number haven't even completed high school. All right, that does it. We'll be back with the final seconds of feedback on this Friday in just a bit. Stay with us.
Talk and weather.
It's the topics that matter to me.
A new generation of talk. News Talk 830 WEEU.
Enjoy the rest of your Good Friday and a happy Easter to those of you who celebrate it. I hope that you get together with your family and friends to enjoy the day. In the meantime, we've got a weekend here, don't we? Yeah, and then it's Monday. We'll be here on Monday, and I'll be joined by Congresswoman Chrissy Houlihan from 11:30 to noon, so I hope you'll tune in for that here on Feedback. I want to thank everybody who called in, texted in, or emailed in with their opinions on the topics of the day. That's what makes this show count. I want to thank Mike Keller for filling in at the last minute to do producer work. What a yeoman's job you did today. I turned your microphone off, by the way. Folks, enjoy the rest of your weekend. Happy Easter. We'll do it again on Monday, and until then, make it a great rest of your day today. That'll do it for this episode of Feedback. To comment on the show, you can email us at feedback@830weeu.com. You can also hear our show live from 9 a.m. to noon Eastern Time at 830weeu.com or on the TuneIn app. For producer Sean Tansky, I'm Bill Saunders. Thanks for listening.